Receive the Power, the song for World Youth Day, recorded not by a Catholic but a Pentecostal. Guy Sebastian is our guest on Sunday night. Guy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How did you feel when you got a ring from the Catholic Church saying, hey, would you be interested in recording something for us?
I was honoured. Absolutely. I've never really considered myself as a Pentecostal or as a, branded to any denomination. I feel I'm really just a Christian who, reads the Bible and believes in God. But I think it's great. I mean, it was actually open to all songwriters, regardless of denomination or anything. So yeah, it was great. A friend came over who is a Catholic, one of my best friends, and he said, oh, look, they're looking for a song. They've, sent it out to a number of songwriters and hundreds, I think, applied for it. But they didn't have the song yet. And they gave me a good brief on what they needed. And it's based around the verse of Acts 1:8, which I guess is every Christian's mandate, where, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you and to be a witness to the ends of the earth. And, I guess under that umbrella of, witness is so much, but mainly love. We're all called to love. And that's what I wanted to capture in this song, that this whole event, every nation, every tribe is coming together and they're there for the cause of Christ, which is love. So it was a easy song that came about.
Yeah. There's another thing about it too, and it's the style of the song. You clearly have had enough experience in writing and singing, even at a relatively young age, to actually have a feel for what the event itself would be like where the song is used. So there's a sense in which you can feel this is a song for a big audience, easy to sing, and we can sort of basically sway along together.
Yeah, it just floats. I guess you don't want something which is, people are going to have to hear, 5-6 times before they can actually sing along. We launched this song and welcomed the cross into the country on Sunday, last Sunday, and it was an awesome event. And by the second chorus, people were already singing along, which was great. And that's what you want to achieve with a song like this. It's an anthem, it's something that people need to identify with quickly.
It's sort of up there, Kazali for the Catholic Church.
That's right.
Musical inspiration's a funny thing. It comes out of who you are as much as what you listen to. Where do you define your groove? Because you actually not only sing, you write and produce. I mean, you consider yourself a musician in that sense. Is there a set of influences which you say, look, this is what shapes me musically?
I think what shapes you musically comes from a whole different bunch of sources. There's those bands and those groups and singers that I used to listen to when I was a young child. I used to sit by the radio and tape, the my favorite song that used to come on radio. And I know that's illegal. I was a naughty little kid.
Your parents must have known that you were musically inclined if you were doing that sort of thing when you were a little kid.
Yeah, but they got me onto violin early on. So I learned violin for about 6 years and hated it, to be honest. Just didn't appeal to me at all, and I picked up some drumsticks and I played drums for a few years and then started singing in my early teens. And to be honest, the first time I sung was a bit woeful. I sang at a cousin's wedding and nothing came out because I was so scared and nervous, but then the next time I sung was at school. I sung this big ballad by Boyz II Men, actually, and as a young kid, I was a big Boyz II Men fan, it sort of made a few people cry, which is when I realised the power of music.
Guy, you mentioned sort of musical influences like Boyz II Men, but let's talk about your family influences as well. You've come from a very interesting multicultural background. Just tell us a little bit about your family.
It's a bit complicated. I mean, when we talk about blood, let's talk about my bloodline first. But my mum's very fair because she's basically white with blue eyes, but she's English Irish and I think there's Portuguese in there or something. And then my dad is Sri Lankan, and I think he must have some Portuguese. That's where the Sebastian comes from, I think. But culturally, my dad was born and raised in Malaysia, my mum was born and raised in India, so I get very good food at home.
It's another thing about the music too, with that Asian influence. I mean, in a song like the one that we, the anthem, there's a sense there in which you're picking up to the feel of Asian pop music. There's a sort of gentle
Yes, sort of
sway to that, and a very strong melodic line as
well. Yes, they love their ballads over there. Like, actually, my first song, which was Angels Brought Me Here, it was, it did quite well in Asia because it just catered to that market perfectly. But, yeah, I think it needed to be that sort of song where it just, just floats and is easy to sing.
When did you decide you wanted to be a musician?
I think it was after that time we were talking about before where I looked out after singing for the first time in front of all my mates. And these are guys that, you know, I'd played footy with for years and played cricket with for so long. And I was almost a bit apprehensive to
sing. How old were you?
I was probably about 13 or 14, I think.
Had the voice broken?
It had just only just broken. So it just was at a stage where I just figured out the whole, you know, deep voice thing sang, and a couple of my mates were actually in tears. It was quite a strange thing. And it was then that I realized that music is, it's not just something that you put on the radio. It's not just something that you play in your car, but it's something that really has a power over people. And I think at the same time, that was around when I started getting into church as well. So, yeah.
Let's talk about that. Had you always gone to church? Your parents were sort of active Christians, committed Christians?
Well, my parents were, yeah, which was great. They took us to church when I was young. And once I got a bit older, I wasn't into church at all. And growing up, I didn't really get it. You know, as a kid, I thought it... I think I was too caught up in the religion side of things, which really goes against what the Bible says, you know.
What do you mean by that?
I think I got caught up just in, I'd go to church on a Sunday religiously every week. We'd say our Lord's Prayer. We'd say the things that we, you know, but it wasn't until my late teens that I realized that actually Christianity is about having a relationship with God and actually doing things not out of obligation, but out of, you know, adoration and out of a love for him for everything that he's done for us.
Yes, it goes from the external to the internal.
Exactly.
But there's a bit of a problem with that, particularly for kids going through that period, because that internalization for some of them becomes a rejection of what their parents stand for. I mean, to become who you are means rejecting a lot of that stuff, doesn't it? But that didn't happen for you?
Well, I was fortunate because I had... you know, great parents. I had great parents who had a great belief system and morally, you know, were just, very caring and led me down the right path, you know, but not everybody has that. And actually probably most people nowadays that they don't always have, the most stable upbringing. When you look at statistics, you know, there's, you know, over 50% of the divorce rate. There's, you know, there's so many things which I guess make it a lot harder. So I was blessed to be raised in a family where, you know, there wasn't really any dramas.
You didn't have the big angst moment where you had to say, I'm going to put aside all my parents stand for and stand for who I am.
No, I think I just think because there's never been a point where, and never will be, where there's a point where I believe that my parents are standing for the wrong thing, and so we were definitely on the same page. So once again, I was just very very fortunate.
What are the things that most stand out to you about the Christian message? Well, what is it for you that makes you say, look, these are the things that I think are really significant about Christianity, and I look for it in other places?
Well, there's definitely the compassion. I think that's not just a Christian thing, of course. I think we all have a mandate. We all have a responsibility, you know, living in a country like Australia, to definitely have compassion for the less fortunate. But on a Christian level, I think the most important things to me, when I look at other Christians or when I look at myself mainly, I think the most important thing I want to say as a Christian is that God is love. You know, when you actually read the Bible, you discover that God, you know, is a God who loves and he accepts people. And it doesn't matter, you know, where a person is at their life, that nobody is more worthy of his love than the other. And we get so caught up, you know, as human beings sometimes, you know, with judging others, with that sort of stuff, but that's not representative of who God is. So I try in my life to be as, you know, non-judgmental and as loving. And, you know, you don't have to tell people that you're a Christian most of the time, because when you love somebody, people identify a message within you anyway.
It's that line of St. Francis, I think it was, when people criticised him for perhaps not preaching all the time. He said, I preach every day and sometimes I use words.
Exactly. Well, exactly. Well, the thing is, we're all called to worship God. You know, we're all called to worship. And worship isn't just, you know, it's not just the fruit of our lips, but it's actually something which is a heart that wants to share with others and be compassionate.
That's a key thing about, it's a key argument that goes on in a lot of Christian circles these days, particularly given the revival of the interest in sort of Pentecostal Christianity, charismatic Christianity in its broader sense, is an argument about what true worship is, whether it is sort of singing songs in church or whether it's feeding the hungry.
Oh, no way, yeah. Singing songs in church is such a minute, you know, part of worship. You know, there's a verse in Hebrews which says, you know, that worship is not just by the fruit of your lips, but it's also to do good unto others and to share the message of Christ. And so, you know, sharing the message of Christ isn't literally going and saying, oh, you know, Jesus loves you or whatever. It's actually the message of Christ was love and compassion.
So we're not talking about the four spiritual laws here.
No, we're not. as a Christian, I always try and, remind myself that, you know, worship just isn't in your song. It's not just in the gift that God gave you, but it's actually in the sacrifice, that you're willing to have, and that's what true worship is the sacrifice, so that you can share the message with others.
We spoke a little bit about your growing up. You grew up in Adelaide, different town from Melbourne and Sydney.
Absolutely.
Cultural adjustment?
Yeah, it's, Adelaide, I was there just a couple of days ago, it's progressing a lot as far as the infrastructure goes. You know, there's buildings going up and estates going up everywhere, but it is such a massive shift when you go from Adelaide to Sydney.
What were the good things about growing up in a city?
Loads.
Like Adelaide?
I mean, Adelaide is, it's so beautiful. It's picturesque. It's very flat, easy to get around. You know,
ride a bike.
Exactly. The city's, you know, north, west, south, east terraces, and in between is just a gridlock system, which is so easy to follow. And, you know, 20 minutes out of Adelaide, you're nearly seeing kangaroos, which is great. It means you're not, you know, the travel time to work and home isn't taking up your whole day. I mean, you find people who travel for an hour and a half, 2 hours back and forth here in Sydney. Yeah.
Does that affect youth culture, particularly in churches, the way people relate to their churches and that sort of thing?
I don't know. I think there's a definite difference in culture in churches, I've found, and I don't know whether that's just my experience.
How do you explain it? What do you think the difference is?
I guess over it sort of transcends with everything, not just church, but you know, Sydney has an air of ambition to it, and so I think. I've got to be careful how I say it.
No, be as blunt as you like. You know, we're hovering over the nullarboy.
I just think when you're in a place which is so much bigger and where so much can be achieved, it enables you to dream a little bit bigger. And I think that's one difference I've found is people tend to dream bigger when they're in a bigger pond, you know, and so it's a bit
more in your face too.
It is, yeah, absolutely. There's a bit more ambition, which is when it's good ambition, it's great.
What are your ambitions? Where do you see yourself going?
For me, I'd love to obviously keep singing. Keep doing albums. I've got a great little project which is just coming together beautifully at the moment, which is a Memphis soul album, and heading over to Memphis in about a month and going to get the original Stax band together. Booker T, Steve Cropper, all of the guys have put up their hand and they've
that
all
is
agreed.
Fantastic.
Oh, mate, I can't wait. So you're talking.
Do you use contacts to get that? I mean, when you talk about bringing together the best session musicians available, they're in such demand that usually it's a matter of word of mouth that this person is worth working with.
Yeah, that's usually the way it is. And so my manager got in touch with the guys and Universal Music and Sony Music have Universal Publishing is pretty active because a lot of it is published by Universal and the Stax label. And then, you know, my record company has been so supportive with just getting over there and saying, you know, are you interested? They've sent the music. And so, yeah, I guess you are very aided by your record company. They've just been so on, you know, hands-on with this whole project. And so, yeah, I'm heading over in August. I record with a band. You know, we're talking songs like I'm Gonna Wait Till the Midnight, all those old school songs, you know, and Let's Stay Together. And, oh, my goodness, just the best songs that just feel good. And so, yeah.
So this won't be a specifically religious album. This is a crossover album?
Oh, it's not really religious at all, to be honest. It's more that, yeah, you know, the Sam and Dave, I'm a soul man, you know, hold on, I'm coming, all that sort of stuff. So the more fun, you know, hooky horn lines. And for me, it just, I'll, you know, it's one of those albums. I wanted to do an album that people put on at a party. And song after song, those horn lines come in, yeah, and people identify, yeah, with it. And so, yeah.
I know. You don't need to convince me about horn lines. I come from a Salvation Army bandmate.
So oh, I've got awesome.
I've got it all. But you mentioned those lines, like gospel artists like Sam Cooke. We play a lot of Sam Cooke on Sunday nights here. And you can hear the way the guy takes gospel and puts it into a secular setting with it almost changes nothing.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, he's one of those artists that doesn't need to change, you know. That gospel was so commercial back then anyway, so it's amazing.
Yeah. What about your ambitions wider than just being a recording artist? Because you've also got skills as a writer and a producer, in a sense. You're genuinely interested in the business.
Yeah, well definitely, you know, I guess for me, I want to take advantage of the fact that I'm still... you know, I'm still a performer and still a recording artist, but obviously, you know, through the years, I want to dedicate also some time to developing other artists and writing for other artists and also obviously some gospel stuff to get out there and go to the States with as well.
Is there much cooperation between Australian artists who do see the chance to move overseas? I mean, people like Darlene Check made a reputation here in Australia, and the whole Hillsong enterprise sort of carried her into the States. So that was a different one. But you've also got other examples, people like James Morrison, who've come up through the whole jazz scene, again, independently, not out of a church scene, but made it big around the world. Yeah. Do you talk to those guys? And is there any sense in which, you know, you get little hints and cooperations around the way?
Well, I'm good friends with Darlene. I saw Darlene last night, and she's always got great advice, you know. And I guess, you know, when I hear that stuff, it is all from a place of worship. I think with gospel stuff, it needs to be genuinely from a heart that seeks to worship. I think it's very easy to identify somebody who is just doing it out of their own ambition or drive. And so I think, you know, when a project is done with a good heart and a heart that wants to worship it, it gets a certain anointing on it that, you know, you can't manufacture. And so, yeah, for me, I just want to do something which you know, I've been dying to do for a while, and I'm sure it'll come in the next couple of years.
There seems to be, though, a struggle in the States that you don't get here. Because the market in the States is as it is, it's so big that people are boxed in. You are either in the gospel market or the contemporary Christian market or the secular market, and Cashbox forces you into these categories because it publishes charts in all these categories. And somebody who wants to cross over and say, look, I'm as much a person in the world as I am a Christian gets into trouble. I mean, Amy Grant, one of the biggest, got into real trouble over that.
I think the whole thing is changing, though. I think that is a thing of the past, and it's not quite there yet, but it is transforming slowly. You know, even within my church, there was, you know, so many people, this was unfamiliar territory for one of the Christian boys who sung on stage to go on a reality TV show, and there's fears that they're going to, you know, almost misrepresent the church. And I guess that's the thing. Christians can't be scared to to go out, because we're all called to be there. We're all called to be there and to love within the world, you know, and you got to be part of it. You can't have an impact in a world that you're not part of. So yeah.
Let's talk about being part of the world musically with one of the artists who's made perhaps some of the biggest impact, both in production-wise and music, and that's Sting. Mm. There's somebody who considers themselves an all-round musician, like Steve. Sting burrows everywhere.
Amazing. Well, I was in London a couple of years ago, and I saw Sting live at the Royal Albert. It was just stunning, amazing. The guy had a sore voice, but he still sung, you know, above.
Was he doing the sort of madrigals of John Downland and others? Oh. I mean, it's early English music.
Oh, exactly. It? Well, that night he played the old Police stuff, and he played his original stuff as well. And mate, the guy's a genius, and like you said, a musical just genius.
Sting's one of those artists, guy who sees himself as a total musician and somebody who's an integrated person first. So he can go off in any direction he wants to because he's so sure of who he is.
Yes.
That's an unusual characteristic to find in artists, because quite often artists are busy trying to be somebody else.
Yeah.
I mean, the classic is Peter Sellers. He never knew who he was.
I think it's something I've been very conscious of and you know, something which I decided, you know, straight away that I wasn't going to try and be something else. I was going to be honest. You know, I got asked about personal things that people normally don't talk about. And
yeah, they even had sort of stuff going about, you know, is Guy gay?
Yeah.
Which was one of the lines a few years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was those rumours and then all sorts of things. But I think that the gay things came out of the fact that I'm, you know, not seen around with multiple models or whatever, it's just a choice for me. I never come from a school of you know, people are doing the wrong thing if they're not doing it this way or whatever. I it's a decision that I've made. I've found that it works for me, and I think people always know when they see a lifestyle that leads to destruction. I mean, it's we all know what sort of lifestyle leads to a shallow existence and an existence which will, you know, end in destruction. And you know, but I think everyone needs to go on that journey for themselves, and no one can really, you can only advise people, you can only love people, and it's up to them to make that decision. And sometimes they even need to go through those dark times and do stupid things to realize, you know, that there's a different path for them.
You ever been through a dark time? You say you've never been sort of down the broader path, but what's been the bleakest moment for you? Did you ever get a point where you think, oh, I can't hack this?
I think everybody has dark moments, you know, and they all differ in intensity. For me, it was really just an adjustment of my life, you know, an adjustment in my head of who I was and this journey that had happened so quickly. And
pressure can do it to you.
Oh, absolutely, the stress. But that pressure, in my position, it always comes from expectation. And when you're in a position where there's expectations upon you and you're in a creative world, and if that creativity isn't flowing or if people start saying certain things about you, then if you place your self-worth on, for example, if you place your self-worth on how many screams you get when you get out on a red carpet or how many girls are interested in you or where your last song charted, if you place all the emphasis and all your self-confidence in that, then it's a dangerous place to be, because you can self-destruct. And the nature of this business is it's up and down, and you always got to place your self-confidence in the fact that you're doing what you're called to do and you know, you got to do it to the best of your ability, and life just throws, you know, a shoe at your head sometimes. And so, yeah.
Guy, what do you look for in a song, be it religious or non-religious? I mean, what makes you think this is worth singing or playing or fooling around with?
I guess on a, on a religious level, I don't look for music that challenges me so much. For when I put worship on in the morning or something, I just look at it as, you know, that music is going to tune me for the day, and it's going to get me in the right mind frame. And it not always does, you know. Sometimes you'll forget, or you'll get on the road and someone will abuse you, and you'll abuse them back. But sometimes, you know, when you prepare yourself in the morning, and that is so easily done with song, it can actually put you in a position where you are shaped for that day. You don't respond, or you know.
But when you hear a bit of music, what is it that turns you on? Like, for example, you're immersed in contemporary musical mm-hmm. culture. You say you started to learn music as a kid on the violin. Now, with the violin, you're learning basically scales and arpeggios, and you hear a bit of Bach and maybe a bit of Mozart. What do you listen to? Is there a is there a corner where occasionally you'll sit down and say, I'd just like to listen to some Mozart or something like that?
Absolutely. I think for me, the thing that turns me on most about a song is the melody. You know, and other people are different. Some people who aren't so musically minded might look at a beat. And, you know, you've got all these kind of urban style songs, and people in that sort of genre really love the big, you know, and then you'll get to the real music lovers who don't like loudness, and of course they'll, you know, tune into your more AC stations and the people that play a lot of these old sort of arrangements and orchestral arrangements. But for me, I look at it, it doesn't matter if it's rock or gospel or anything. If it's got a great hooky, beautiful melody that moves well with the chords, then I'm hooked in. I'm a sucker for that.
Guy Sebastian, it's been great to have you on Sunday night as a guest.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little more before we finish with the papal anthem, the Youth Day anthem.
Yes.
About the sorts of ambitions one has for an event like this. Will you be going along? Have they asked you to turn
singing.
Up and do it live?
Yeah, well, I'm singing.
With His Holiness?
Yeah, apparently. I mean, I get asked.
He's a great fan of Mozart. You need to be aware.
Oh, really?
Aware. Okay. His brother was a very good choir director, too. His brother had one of the best cathedral choirs in Europe. So he's a bit of a music man.
Yeah.
Bloke.
Oh, great. Well, I mean, you know, the approval had to go from here, you know, the Archdiocese here and Cardinal Pell through to... Then to Rome, and then, you know, all the archbishops there, and all the priests, and everyone, you know. Usually, you just
it's been vetted.
Yes, exactly.
Is there a theological dissertation been written upon it?
Oh, there is. I've got a theological reflection of Receive the Power. I do, and I haven't read it yet. It's on my laptop desktop, but I haven't. I'm not a very. I'm not big on theology, really, myself. But I will read it before the Pope gets here.
Guy Sebastian, great to have you on Sunday night. Let's finish with the international version of "Receive the Power." Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.